All right, good morning. Good to see you all there. Thanks for that song, Mo.
Hey, Mo.
Little Lynyrd Skynyrd influence there. Is anybody hearing that? Yeah, okay, not just me. I love that, though. So good. Well, good morning. We are continuing on in our study through the parables, and we'll be in Luke chapter 14 today, if you want to flip ahead there. I've been enjoying this. I hope you've been enjoying the parables. We talk about our church being a safe place to heal and a brave space to grow, and how God is doing both of these things often at once in our lives. That all of us come today with wounds that need healing, with trauma that needs to be resolved. It's just a matter of life where we go through and we receive these wounds to our heart that God takes and turns and uses to transform to our glory, to form us into who he's calling us to be, which in the end is to be like his son. That we would learn how to love and to love like God loves. This is sort of the journey of life. And Jesus presents this picture for us in these parables, in these stories, to help show us where we've gotten off, to correct us where we've gotten stuck, and then to expand our minds to help us see more of what he refers to as his kingdom. And Jesus, when he teaches on the kingdom, he usually does it like these two things at once. I think it's funny, like when people come to him and say, what's the most important thing? He says, well, it's two things, right? What's the most important thing? Well, to love God with your heart and soul and mind and strength. And the second, just like it, to love your neighbor as himself. And I hold my hands like this to go, you kind of get this top down and this bottom up side of this one thing. That to love God, this is like our greatest calling. But instead of it just being some big ethereal abstract concept out here, he gets really practical and goes, if you want to love God, love your neighbor like you love yourself. And you see this in each of the parables, a truth of God's kingdom, a sort of top-down perspective, as well as a wonderful sort of nuts and bolts practical example of how to live. And we're going to see that in our parable today as we look at this parable around social interaction, around social value, and the things that the world values versus the things that the kingdom or God's kingdom values. There's an essay I've quoted for you before, but it's one I like by C.S. Lewis. It's called The Inner Ring. Has anybody read this essay? It's a little obscure in his writings, but it's an address he gave to a bunch of graduates. And he uses this example from War and Peace, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's an interesting moment in this story. Yeah, right? Right? Where Boris walks in, and he's talking to Andre, and Boris is a second lieutenant, and Andre's a captain, and he interrupts this meeting with a general, the highest ranking, right? He walks in, and all of a sudden, Andre turns towards Boris and goes, yeah, and he says to the general, just a second here. And what Boris realizes is that there's sort of two systems at play. There's the military ranking of who's more powerful, and then there's what he calls this unwritten system, this special system. It says here, Boris now clearly understood what he had already guessed, that side by side with the system of discipline and subordination, which were laid down in the army regulations, there existed a different and more real system, the system which compelled a tightly laced general with a purple face to wait respectfully for his turn, while a mere captain like Prince Andre chatted with a mere second lieutenant like Boris. Boris decided at once that he would be guided not by the official system, but by this other unwritten system, the inner ring. If any of you have been in the inner ring, it's like such a good feeling, right? A good feeling like potato chips are good. Right? Where you're you just want more, right? You just want it, and you can't stop yourself. It's this idea of being in that sort of inner circle. And it's not just a matter of who's there, but who's not there. how this system works. This sort of social power that's created by the inner ring. I remember one day where I was in the inner ring, and I had gone down to hear somebody speak at Point Loma, and I have a friend there that's a chaplain who had brought this like VIP speaker in and knew that there was going to be some gaps in the day. And she just said, "Jeff, would you just walk around with the speaker?" And I was like, "Yeah, of course." I'd known him from this little thing before. So I did. So he and I spent that day just kind of walking around. But she said, "You know what's funny is at the end of the day," she's like, "more question, the question I got today is like, who is that guy with so-and-so?" Right? That I was there and people are like, "I don't know him, but who is he? He's with the VIP, right?" And I remember thinking, oh, that feels kind of good. That this, we have this sort of appetite for being in the inside track. And I think what Jesus is going to identify in our passage today is that that is Turkish delight. That is incredibly dangerous to us. That there is something in us that longs for this honor, but in a sort of positional way. A way that insists on us like maximizing what we're good at and then like maybe in turn minimizing the values of others or exalting ourselves higher than we should be while holding others down, this system. And honestly, it's the power of social media, right? Not to just keep pointing the finger at that, but that fear of FOMO, of missing out, it's all driven by this unwritten social system. And there's sneaky ways of doing it, too. I mentioned this last week, like posturing in a humble way when really what you're doing is exalting yourself, right? I quoted this thing from David Brooks that I'll repeat. He says, "You're not trying to show you're better than anybody else. You're showing that you are a regular, normal person despite the fact that your life is so much more fabulous than those people around you." Right, this is a humble way of doing this. Nobody ever says, "I'm so proud of the fact." They say, "I'm humbled that," but really what that does is it masks a sort of pride. And Jesus is going to call this out as sort of the world system of value. And the problem is that in this who is in and who is out, that people are being cast aside. And anybody that's in, if we're honest, never really feels in, right? The same way when you're eating potato chips, you never really feel satisfied or full. You just keep eating and eating and eating. And this system, it's subtle. It's happening without us even knowing it. We walk into a room and we kind of figure out where we fit in the sort of social system there. How important am I? How do I measure up? And probably all of us have this way of putting ourselves sort of on the top end, right? How many of us think that we're an important person or think that we're special? I think the last time they measured that, it was like 80% of people think they're special, right? Which that means you're, right? You can't all be. These ways of looking at ourselves. And Jesus is going to walk into this social circle because he's at the beginning of his ministry. And people recognize him as intelligent. And they recognize him as powerful. In fact, in this moment, Jesus is going to walk in on the Sabbath day to this celebration or to this gathering. And he's going to heal somebody. Somebody that comes in with what's called dropsy or edema. And in this moment, he heals this person at the party, and it creates this sort of buzz. All the important people are there, all these VIPs, and where you sit matters. And what he notices is all these people jockeying for position. And so Jesus is going to use this as an opportunity to explain the kingdom. He's also going to use it as an opportunity to describe how ultimately bankrupt this whole game is that everybody is playing. And he does this not to shame them. He does it because he goes, "This is a cancer and you don't realize it. This way of seeing the world, this way of who's in and who's out, who's included, who's excluded, is at the root of so much of the evil and sin in our world today." And that may seem a little over-dramatized, but I think the truth is it is just pride in its sort of raw essence, this insecure, self-centered pride. And what we can so easily do without even realizing it is mask it even in our religiosity. We mask it as humble when in fact it's self-projecting. And Jesus is going to say, ultimately, we try to hold these two things at once, and they cannot coexist, not long term. And in Luke 16, he says, no one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. And that's a little ominous because most of us are trying to do just that. How do we serve God and money? How do we maintain a sort of social clout at the same time, make sure that everything is good between God and I? And he's saying these desires at a certain point start to tear against each other. It creates a sort of hypocrisy in the heart. And so if you look, hopefully you're there at Luke 14, if you look at verse 7, Jesus is going to start to teach in this environment. I mean, I wonder if they knew he was this sort of rising star, maybe even gave him a platform, like, Jesus, do you have anything to say? And they're going to sort of regret asking him that, right? And in verse 7, it says, now he told a parable to those who were invited when he noticed how they chose the places of honor, saying to them, when you're invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in a place of honor, lest someone more distinguished than you be invited by him. And he who invited you both will come and say to you, give your place to this person. And then you will begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when you're invited, go and sit in the lowest place, so that when your host comes by, he may say to you, friend, move up higher. Then you will be honored in the presence of all who sit at a table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. It's like a little hack, almost. How do you keep this thing in us that's starving for honor and to try to possess it? What do we do about that? And Jesus says, well, it's real easy. Just when you walk into a social situation, just choose the worst seat. If you're supposed to be sitting somewhere higher, somebody will come get you. But how embarrassing when you fight for that seat only to realize it belongs to somebody else. It's so pragmatic, right? But in the end, Jesus is saying it's about humility, which we see again and again is at the core when it comes to character, when it comes to love, when it comes to wisdom. In fact, Jesus here may be just quoting from Proverbs. Proverbs 25, 6-7 says, do not put yourself forward in the king's presence or stand in the place of the great, for it's better to be told, come up here, than to be put lower in the presence of a noble. And this is what's interesting. Honor is not a bad thing. Glory is not a bad thing. It's just that we are so bad at handling it, aren't we? The second we get it, we do something weird with it. And so Jesus is saying this is really a posture of the heart, of open-handedness, where we're not pursuing, we're not clutching, we're not seeking to attain honor. Instead, we're living in this place of humility. And as it turns out, oftentimes, that honor will come and find you. That the real value is there. And is part of what you were made for, every single one of you. I think that idea of, am I special, right? Jesus is going, no, that you were made for a glorious inheritance. You were made for honor. You were made for a larger story. It just doesn't look like the one you're trying to build for yourself. So the best thing that you can do is let that go. When you walk in, here's all the seats. There's the boring table. Just go sit at the boring table, right? For lack of a better word. 1 Peter 5, 5-7, Peter says this, in the same way, you who are younger, submit yourself to your elders. All of you clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, because God opposes the proud, but shows favor to the humble. Humble yourself, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. Cast all your anxiety on him, because he cares for you. And this, to me, I think Peter so marvelously gets at the dynamic of what's going on. Peter, who was one who vied for power, right? There's a guy who gets it. So he's not saying this is like, what's wrong with you guys? He's going, no, this is what he had to learn. That when we humble ourselves, that God will exalt us. But when we cast this anxiety on him, we receive something even more. God's caring hand at work, God raising us up. This is the way honor is supposed to be experienced. that when we hold it open-handed, we're able to have that honor without it burning us or possessing us. We can have honor and freedom with humility. Jesus turns from the crowd and now looks at the host. And he said also to the man who invited him, when you give a dinner or a banquet, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you. For you will be repaid at the resurrection of the just. So there's a whole other way. There's how you behave as a guest. You go to the lowest seat. How do you behave as a host? You invite the people that have nothing to give you in return. Which again, like this unwritten system, right? Nobody's going to admit that they pick their list based on what these people have to give, but we all probably sort of do, right? Like, if we can get the cool people here, then it really will be a party. How do we get a guest list where everybody's like, oh, that was the place to be? In fact, if you get the cool people, then everybody will want to be there, right? This is how you throw a really good party. And Jesus is saying, this isn't how I throw a party. It's not what I do. I don't go get the influential people to be there or the people that have a certain buzz around them. I get the people there that need it, that like are longing for connection, the people that are looking to belong, the people that other people have forgotten about. This is what we're here to do, to draw people in from the outside. And remember this, Jesus is talking about how the kingdom works, which really is about abundant life, right? It just shows you how wrong we get this. We throw these super cool parties and then feel all insecure about it. And Jesus is saying, just get over that game. Invite the people that are longing for connection. Why? Because there's joy in that. It's deeply meaningful. But it is a terrible way to create like that party with buzz, right? And so we have to understand this, that this is costly, what Jesus is suggesting. It's a discipline. And again, like that way we try to play both of these things at once. But when we throw that party where it's the cool place to be, it's just another version of the world's party. It looks nothing like the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom is one that is outward facing and drawing others in. The kingdom is one that looks for those that are hurting or seen as having no value, and looking at them with their true value intact. Because this is the way that Jesus sees. He looks at every single one of them and sees that heart of a child. How often we pay attention to people with power or prestige or clout or reputation. I think about this even, like the people that I rush to respond to their email, right? Because I want to make sure that person, you know, feels like, oh yeah, Jeff's paying attention to me, right? Like the tendency to think about that in terms of a whole system of like, who matters most? What would it be like to flip that whole system on its head as you're scanning through your emails, right? To find the people with nothing to repay you and address them first. Do you see what I mean? And he's not trying to create some hard and fast legalistic set of rules here as much as he's trying to get us to retrain our hearts. That heart that longs for that self-recognition, to instead experience this selflessness, this freedom, a self-forgetfulness. Because it's that person that's truly at peace and that person that's truly able to experience joy, the one who's forgotten this whole game. And this exclamation breaks out at this point in the party. It says, when one of those who reclined at a table with him heard these things, he said to him, blessed is everyone who will eat bread in the kingdom of God. Which is, I think, I looked up the technical term for this. It's called a bromide. It's like a statement that somebody makes where in a like awkward moment, they just shout something out, like positive, like, we'll die for you. Like, you know, whatever this is, it's trying to lighten the tension. I love you, man. Somebody shouts this out. Blessed is everyone, right? As Jesus goes, hey, even the least are going to get in. This guy shouts out, everybody gets in. And Jesus goes, well. And in verse 16, it says, but he said to him, a man once gave a great banquet and invited many. And at the time for the banquet, he sent his servant to say to those who had been invited, come, for everything is now ready. But they all like began to make excuses. The first said to him, I've bought a field and I must go out and see it. Please have me excused. And another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen and I will go examine them. Please have me excused. And another said, I have married a wife and therefore I cannot come. And this, you know, I think as we read this, you know, you hear these people saying, yes, I'm going to be there, and then they don't show up, right? All the introverts now are like, ooh, that's my move. And I don't think that's what Jesus is talking about here. This isn't introverted behavior. I think this is a fleshing out instead of the dynamic that Jesus has been describing. And these are people that say, oh, yeah, with kind of their lips, like, sure, I'll be there. But in the end, for very petty reasons, decline the invitation. They check yes on the RSVP, and then they don't show. And why? For a set of reasons. And commentators have debated, is there something more to these reasons? And I'm one of those that thinks there is. That these are last-second cancellations, but there's something almost sinister behind them. It's dismissive. But also might point to competing matters of the heart. So I'm just going to take a stab at it. The recent purchase of land. This is somebody who goes, yeah, I was going to come, but I made this business deal last second, and I'm on my way there to do it, right? A sort of impulsiveness, or like, yeah, sorry, I was going to be there, but all this stuff I've got going on, right? It's this way of demonstrating a level of importance, like, yeah, I was going to come to your party, but I have much more pressing matters to attend to. I'm that important, right? This guy's made a business deal. Please excuse me. Crosses his name off the list. The second guy, he goes, and again, like part of the suspect, like he's going to this sort of evening gathering, and you're like, you're going to check out your field now? That's like odd timing, right? The second guy, I bought these oxen and I've got to go see them, right? And I read this one commentator who said, let me see if I can find it. I'm off my notes here. This idea of like buying a car that you haven't seen. Oh, calling your wife and canceling dinner because you've just bought a used car over the phone. And you're now going to go to the used car lot to find out what kind it is, how old it is, and whether or not it will start. Like, I bought these oxen, sorry. Got to go check them out, right? Like, as opposed to, you didn't check these things out before you bought the oxen, right? It's kind of a weak excuse. This other guy, oh, I just got married. And, which some commentators would say is more of maybe like a sexual reference, like, sorry, my passions have distracted me from the party. Whatever it is, what you see is these people that can't be bothered. The preparations that the host has made, the invitations that he's extended, these people with this sort of social clout all find themselves just a little too busy or preoccupied or too focused on their own self. They're thinking to themselves, well, you'd be honored if I showed up, but I just don't have the time. And so the story goes on. It says the servant came and reported these things to his master. See, the servant had gone to all these people's homes to just remind them, hey, the party's about to start. And they're like, ah, I won't be here. And the servant came and reported these things to his master. Then the master of the house became angry and said to his servant, go out and quickly to the streets and the lanes of the city and bring in the poor and the crippled and the blind and the lame. And the servant said, sir, what you commanded has been done, and still there is room. And the master said to the servant, go out to the highways and hedges, compel people to come in, that my house may be filled. For I tell you, none of these men who are invited shall taste my banquet." And Jesus takes this story and he's putting it in very practical terms. This is how you behave at parties. This is what it's like when you host parties. But then he casts this all through this parable in this much larger timeline. That these sort of patterns of the heart have what looks to be ultimate consequences. That the people that simply don't have time today are not going to have time tomorrow. That our behavior has this way of compounding and building and setting this course for our lives that becomes harder and harder for us to change course from. And Jesus says, this is what the host, this is what the king will do, is he's going to go out and offer this to whomever will come. To all the outcast groups, to all the people with the sullied reputations, to the people that society looks down on. Guess what? These are the people welcomed in. And even then, there's room. So he goes out beyond the boundaries. And he says, compel them. Why? These are people that are so broken. These are people that feel so much shame that when somebody comes out and extends love to them, they look at them with suspicion and distrust. Nobody has treated them well. Nobody has extended generosity. They have nothing to give in return. And Jesus is going, this is the offer of the kingdom. This is how good God is. This whole inner ring game isn't even a thing. This way of evaluating and creating these rules and trying to determine who's better and who's worse, God's going, it's not my metric. That's not how I see value at all. That he looks at this world and he sees right into their heart. And as it turns out, we get this entirely backward. We ascribe value to outward things, and God has nothing to do with that. He looks right at the heart, but that those outward pursuits have a way of creating a sort of inner decay to our heart, affecting our ability to love, affecting our ability to see, to listen, to hear the things that matter. That this inner ring is this like stifling, shrinking little world that ultimately collapses in on itself. And this is what pride does. It creates self-absorption, enslavement to ourselves. This is Luke's gospel. And Luke tells these stories a little bit different than Matthew does. If Matthew tells a story, he would say at some point here, and then there was weeping and gnashing of teeth. Matthew does that probably six different times, maybe seven times in his gospel. But I think what he's getting at there, that phrase, is not a statement of like pain. It's a statement of like deep resentment coupled with regret. These are people that have been sort of foiled at their game. Some people have even thought that these three people making excuses were kind of doing this power play, like they all got together and said, what if none of us showed up, right? There's this, we're going to do our own thing here. And Jesus is saying the party will still go on. There's going to be this feast, but everybody's invited. One of my heroes of the faith, Henry Nouwen, he left professorship at Yale. He had been at Harvard before that and went and worked with handicapped people in this little community called L'Arche. And he was saying how this saved his heart. And he said that when you serve the poor, you realize that you are all the same. This like massive leveling that the kingdom of heaven does. That all of us have this deep value. That the people that we look down on are as valued, maybe even in God's kingdom, of greater value. And Jesus wants to get us to see with those eyes so that we see others in that way, but so that we see ourselves in that way. When he says, love others like you do, like you love yourself, that has got to get healthy. And he's saying humility is the way to that, not just to love others, but to love yourself, to bring that heart to light. Part of it is realizing that each one here, that we are nobody special in God's kingdom, right? We're just you and just me. None of us get a better seat. And yet the truth is, on the other side of this, each one of you is so brilliant in God's eyes. And that's what God wants you to see. He's down here saying, give up your seat or invite the outcast. But what really the top down is, he's like, I wish that you could see yourself like I see you. And so often we spend our life in like what Peter is referring to there, this anxiety. I'm not going to move. This anxiety around how others see ourselves. Gosh. I do this all the time. I worry. Huh, babe? Patty's nodding in the front. After I give a sermon, I'm like, was that stupid when I said this? Like, it's just that like self-awareness thing, right? And I see God going, yeah, Jeff, let's work on this. And we're going to work on this. And we're going to work on this. Because we're not finished. We're on this journey going more and more and more into humility. And he's saying, look, I want you to have a heart like my son. A heart like Jesus. I love this quote from Dallas Willard. He says, people exist to love as Jesus loved. Indeed, the aim of God in human history is the creation of an all-inclusive community of loving persons with himself at the center of the community as its prime sustainer and most glorious inhabitant. Isn't that cool? God at the center of this thing, this loving community. He's trying to show us how to behave in such a way that that is what our hearts long for. So that our heart longs for heaven instead of longing for this like self-centered focus and obsessiveness. God's breaking us of the one and inviting us to the other. And I've been kind of working on this, and I was thinking about this as I was going through this. I was meeting with this little group, and we were talking through some things about empathy and identity, and she said, I want everybody to bring a picture of yourself as a child. And so I went into my baby book and I found one. And so I've got one for you today. See, all right, there's Jeff. Look at those pants, man. And that belt's like 3 inches thick. And I was thinking and looking at that, like that's who's invited to the party. Right? That guy. Not like, hey, you know, but here's what I've studied, or here's my credentials, or here's the things that I've achieved in this life. Here's what make me an interesting guest at a party, or here's where I might have value here. Right? And God's like, I want that guy who's just joyful, right? And looks at the world like with kind eyes. And God goes, that's who I see. And by the way, all these people that are on the fringes and the margins, that's what they look like to me. Like these little kids with these tender hearts who've been hurt along the way and broken. And then society's come down and doubled down on that and shoved these people off to the side. You can put the picture down if you want. It's a little embarrassing. And this community of belonging. This is what Jesus was all about. He's like, this is how you throw a party. As you find those people there that have lost sight of that value, and you bring them in and you pour out compassion on them. This is how the kingdom of heaven works. This is how you are salty. This is how you create a beautiful community of belonging. And it starts by seeing yourself in that way. Maybe it doesn't have to start by seeing yourself, but that's an integral piece. By seeing what actually is valuable about you, which is your heart. And Jesus is saying, when you live in this way, this is what you get back at the resurrection of the just. Like, you get back your heart. This is what's being formed. This is this thing that is of eternal value. I read this from Brené Brown. She says in her book, Braving the Wilderness, true belonging is the spiritual practice of believing in and belonging to yourself so deeply that you can share your most authentic self with the world and find sacredness in both being a part of something and standing alone in the wilderness. True belonging doesn't require you to change who you are. It requires you to be who you are. And this is, I think, what Jesus is trying to do, is find that soul, that heart that he created, and set that heart free. That you, who he sees of such beauty and truth and belonging and goodness. And it's gotten beaten up, right, along the way. But Jesus comes in and speaks these words as that shepherd to his sheep, these words of deep compassion, the words that go, the shepherd that goes after the lost, the one who goes to find that pearl of great price, as we looked at a few weeks ago. And so Jesus is going to model this downward path that ultimately is going to lead him to the cross. And yet, what do we find? As Paul writes in Philippians, what was on the other side of that downward descent was glory, honor. That is what awaits, and this dying to self becomes necessary, and in that freedom for that restoration, not of this like cheap, self-possessed value, but true honor, to be seen in that vulnerable, transparent state, to shine with that light of God's love. Henry Nouwen says, the great paradox which Scripture reveals to us is that real and total freedom is only found through downward mobility. The Word of God came down to us and lived amongst us as a slave. The divine way is indeed the downward way. And yet what we find out is it's also the upward way. It's the way to abundance. It's the way to joy. And it's the way to freedom. Some questions as we close. Number one, what practical way might you break yourself from playing the social value game? How can you stop seeking the place of privilege and position, not self-sabotage, but instead stepping off that treadmill? Does that make sense? Like, don't go out there and self-deprecate. Don't go out there and be insecure. Just step off that treadmill. What would that look like practically in your life? For a lot of us, maybe you're going like, look, I'm already off social media. Good for you. Or I mean, whatever. Maybe you're like on social media all the time, but need to figure out some way to manage that, right? Maybe this has nothing to do with social media, but everything to do with friendships and interactions and how that all works. What are the ways we place value in others' opinions of ourselves? Number two, what are my excuses I use for not showing up? How do I hide behind business? How do material things keep me from generosity? How do my desires hold me back from honoring others and my commitments? You hear Jesus saying, like, hey, if you RSVP, show up. This is what Kelly would be saying too, by the way. She always tells me, did you RSVP? Then you have to be there. That's right. But what are the things that get in the way of my commitments and my follow through? What are the things, the ways that I deem myself to be more important, too important to stand in line? And number three, how can you play host for the outer rings? How are we serving the least? Not so much church programs that we support, but actual time and relational investment. I mean, we should be as a church doing that as well. But I think Jesus is encouraging each of us as individuals that we go into our day looking for that person that's left out, for that person that's lonely and on the fringe, for that person that doesn't feel like they belong. This becomes our assignment, to go find those people and pull them in. pull them into relationship, pull them into connection, but most of all, to show them God's love for them. And maybe as like a bonus assignment this week, go back and find a little picture of yourself as a kid. And just take a look at it now and then to realize that this is where your value lies. Not in some outward performance, but like look into those eyes of that kid and see what God sees when he looks at you. Would you stand with me? And if you'd like prayer this morning, we will be down front to pray. Maybe you're coming in and you're like, I don't feel like I have any value. Let us pray together. We would love to pray with you. Maybe you're struggling with this. Maybe you're still struggling with that way of looking at the world through the eyes of judgment. We would love to pray with you for freedom, for a deep infilling of God's love. We've got some coffee and pastries out there too for those that are feeling a little bit peckish, but let me leave you with a blessing as we go. That God would bless you and keep you. That God would make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. That God would lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. God bless you. Love you guys.